From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Former Mexico City Mayor Andrés Manuel López Obrador has swept a victory, handily winning Mexico's presidential race. The 64-year-old López Obrador becomes the country's first leftist leader in decades. The ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, has conceded defeat. Wilson Center Mexico expert Duncan Wood said the new leader, faced with endemic corruption and violence, will also have to tackle disputes with the U.S. over trade and migration.
He understands that the economic relationship with the U.S., as well as the political relationship, is of fundamental importance to Mexico's prosperity and security. But, you know, Andrés Manuel is also the kind of figure who will react if there are tweeted insults to Mexico, the Mexican people, or to himself. He's not going to sit there and take it. And you could see the opportunity for a rapid escalation of conflict in a Twitter war.
However, Wood said López Obrador has been vague on how he intends to handle the violence gripping the country.
He's spoken very little about the security situation in the country. And when he has, he's offered some platitudes more than anything else, saying that he would offer amnesty to small producers of drugs, of heroin or of marijuana. But there's no real plan in place for actually confronting organized crime. He says that he will do things differently, but when you question him on it, there's no depth on the policy response.
López Obrador's coalition, led by the Morena Party, appeared to be on track for a strong showing in state and congressional races. An African Union summit opened Sunday in Madagascar with the host country warning of regional security failings amid growing jihadist attacks like the latest one in Mali that killed 4 civilians. Security is a top agenda item of more than 40 African leaders meeting in the capital, Nouakchott. This is VOA News. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton Sunday said he believes most of North Korea's weapons of mass destruction can be dismantled in a year. He appeared on the CBS program Face the Nation.
We have developed a program. I'm sure that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will be discussing this with the North Koreans in the near future about really how to dismantle all of their WMD and ballistic missile programs in a year. If they have the strategic decision already made to do that and they're cooperative, we can move very quickly. And it's to North Korea's advantage to see these programs dismantled very quickly, because then the elimination of sanctions, aid by South Korea and Japan and others, can all begin to flow.
Bolton expressed optimism North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would carry out his country's denuclearization. The leader of Sudan's main opposition party, Sadiq al-Mahdi, said he was refused entry to Egypt, where he's been in self-imposed exile. The Sudanese National Umma Party said he was turned away from after arriving at Cairo's international airport from Berlin, no official reason given for his denial. Marking the 21st anniversary of Hong Kong's return to mainland China, thousands of pro-democracy supporters took to the streets to protest Beijing's tightening grip. Joshua Wong heads the Democisto Party.
It's the first demonstration after Carrie Lam as the one who ruled Hong Kong for a year. And we hope to send a message to Beijing. We are against on interference of China government, and also hope to protect Hong Kong's high degree autonomy.
Organizers said 50,000 turned out, while police put the number lower at less than 10,000. Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Salvini told tens of thousands of League supporters Sunday he hopes to take his message on immigration restriction and job security to the rest of the continent. He said next year's European Parliament elections should be a referendum between the elite, the banks, finance, immigration, and job security, and the Europe of people and work. German Interior Minister Horst Seehofer has offered his resignation from the post, and head of the Christian Social Union, a key coalition partner of Chancellor Angela Merkel's government, over the migration issue. Seehofer backs tighter restrictions on asylum seekers at the border. However, Ms. Merkel said she prefers a European Union-wide solution to the ongoing wave of migration. In Afghanistan, a suicide bomber targeted a convoy of Sikhs and Hindus traveling to meet President Ashraf Ghani in Jalalabad Sunday, killing 19, wounding several others. Islamic State claimed responsibility. National Basketball Association superstar LeBron James leaving his hometown Cleveland Cavaliers for the Los Angeles Lakers on a 4-year, $154 million contract. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, July the 2nd, and here are some of the stories we're covering. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has condemned an attack on a military patrol in northern Mali, which killed 4 civilians and wounded 31 others. And in Somalia, at least 5 civilians were killed and more than 10 others wounded after Al-Shabaab militants fired mortars in a residential area of the capital, Mogadishu. And this month and the past month of June, many African countries celebrate their independence. But as celebrations continue, many question what that independence actually means to the citizens of these countries.
First, the most important thing in independence is the independence economically. If you are not independent economically, you mean that is a problem.
That's a Burundian businessman speaking from the capital, Bujumbura, as the country celebrates its independence anniversary. And of late, Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province has been at the heart of a brewing crisis with what analysts say is an Islamist guerrilla movement and constant skirmishes between police and members of the Al-Sunna wa Jamaa. But many questions remain as to the goals of this militant group.
Community neglect, lack of development, ethnic tensions, and this is all just culminated into a situation manifesting at a level of about 32 independent cells executing attacks against civilians to instill fear.
Jasmine Opperman is a security and terrorism analyst based in South Africa. Those stories plus a story on the subculture of sports betting in Lagos and the World Cup update are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Four civilians were killed in an attack targeting a French patrol in Mali on Sunday. At least 20 other people were injured in the attack, including 8 French soldiers. The ambush in the northern town of Gao involved a car bomb explosion followed by gunfire. It took place 2 days after Islamist militants killed at least 6 people during a raid on a military headquarters in central Mali. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the attack and reiterated the determination of the United Nations to continue to support Malian officials in their efforts to stabilize the country. And in Somalia, at least 5 civilians were killed and more than 10 others wounded after Al-Shabaab militants fired mortars in a residential area of the capital, Mogadishu. Security spokesperson Abdulaziz Ali Ibrahim confirmed to VOA Somali service that the casualties were the results of a mortar attack. Security experts in Mogadishu told VOA Somali that 360mm mortars landed in a civilian neighborhood in Wadajil district near the headquarters of the African Union mission in Somalia. The Al-Shabaab militant group claimed responsibility for the attack and said it targeted the AU forces headquarters. UN Deputy Special Representative for Somalia, Peter de Klerk, said that such attacks by Al-Shabaab were a desperate activity by the militant group. Meanwhile, the United Nations is warning Somaliland and Somalia's state of Puntland that further conflict in the disputed Tuareg area could result in a major humanitarian crisis. This weekend, ambassadors of the United States and France joined dozens of Ugandan demonstrators in the capital, Kampala, to protest against rising violence against women. There has been a number of unsolved murders and kidnappings in the country since early last year. The bodies of more than 20 women have been dumped on roadsides in Kampala. In a speech this month, Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni accused some members of the security forces of working with criminals and announced measures including the collection of DNA from all Ugandans to help fight crime in the country. In a second meeting addressing the security situation in the country, opposition members of parliament asked President Museveni to let them be part of national security bodies. From Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
For the second time this month, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni held another security meeting with members of parliament, heads of security forces and other top government officials to discuss a way forward towards improving security in the country. CAP's Hassan Fungaru, an opposition member of parliament, said after the meeting that the opposition MPs who attended the meeting asked the president to be considered towards improving security in the country.
Why is it that the leader of the opposition or the representative of the leader of the opposition, like the Shadow Minister of Defense or the Shadow Minister of Internal Affairs, are not included in meetings to do with national security matters? Why is it that when it comes to times of elections, NRM is fused with the police, with the army, with the intelligence services to defend the vote in favor of NRM?
Fungaru says both members of parliament from the opposition and the ruling National Resistance Movement Party live in fear after several prominent leaders in the country were murdered in recent days.
MPs are living in fear. Also, MPs reported those who are given escorts by the system, by the president, in terms of police, that the police are running away. Police are saying instead of escorting a member of parliament, he better go home. Because moving with a member of parliament, escorting a member of parliament, is a very big risk for them.
Fungaru says the president suggested providing extra security for the MPs. According to President Museveni's suggestion, MPs are to be given some escort cars as well as escort soldiers. Fungaru also says the president directed the Inspector General of Police to sack police officers that abandoned MPs. Parliamentarian Mohamed Nsereko says he was glad the president invited MPs to give their views concerning national security.
The interaction is not bad. You get to know what those that you do not necessarily agree with think of you, but also think about the country. So matters of security, I think, should be given utmost priority for every single Ugandan.
But opposition member Semakoro Tamaguzi, just like many members of the opposition, decided to boycott the meeting with the president.
We know that is one of the leading causes of the insecurity we have in this country, having removed both the age limit and the term limits. So we don't expect anything much from him.
Ruling party member of parliament Ibrahim Abiriga, one of the initiators of the removal of term limits from the constitution, was gunned down together with bodyguard in Kampala earlier this month. It remains to be seen if the president's suggestion on improving security, which include regulation of social media, drones, gun fingerprints, and a ban on hoods for riders, will be put in place. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Violence has increased in the Cabo Delgado province in Mozambique, with at least 16 attacks and 49 people killed within the last 2 months. But many questions remain as to the group behind these attacks, known as Al-Suna Wal-Jamaa, and their ultimate goal. And for analysis, VOA's Harun Maruf spoke to Jasmine Opperman, a security and terrorism analyst based in South Africa.
Yes, I think it's a very complex matter. I just think the concern now, more than anything else, is the single narrative that is being attributed to the violence, namely that we are sitting with an Islamist insurgent, which there are no indicators or evidence of. We are sitting with a historical context of grievances, community neglect, lack of development, ethnic tensions. And this is all just culminated into a situation clearly manifesting at a level of about 32 independent cells executing attacks against civilians to instill fear. So it's a complex driving force. And to argue that it's Islamist insurgency is not taking into cognizance the reality of these attacks.
What do they want? What's the main drive? What's their target?
If this was an Islamist insurgent, there would have been a clear-cut doctrine, there would have been a clear-cut alternative, there would have been clear-cut structure with leaders stepping in and saying that we can offer a better option than what the Mozambican government is doing. But that is lacking. That is not present. Al-Shabaab or the Shabaab cult is not a group. It is a name being given by locals. And we need to understand how these communities, their culture and thinking. When people from Iraq arrives, example, they will say Iraqis. Or people from the Middle East, they will say, yes, the Taliban. So, and this is what happened with Shabaab. People being seen as from that area has been referred by local communities as Shabab. And now everyone jumps to the conclusion there is a group called Shabab. There is no group called Shabab. What these cells want, I would love to know. What is clear is that they're instilling fear, that they are looting, that they are beheading, that there is extreme brutality. But what their objective is remains a debate, and it remains inconclusive.
How is the government defining them? What is the government saying?
The government at this point in time, two things. One, we are seeing, and this is a concern, and I'm not being critical, a government in denial. For them, this is a local issue that will have to be dealt with in a harsh manner by means of military response. So there's an overwhelming military approach now, and that is not going to solve the problem. There's a deeper rooted problem here, and we've seen it in many other places in the world that needs to be addressed. My concern is PMCs, my private military consultants, seeing the business opportunity, moving in. Over-militarization. Russia and the U.S. are now stepping in. A military solution will not solve this problem.
Is there a connection with a foreign group or militant group?
That there has been foreign influences. Initially, I'm going back to the Al-Sunna group. Most definitely. We must remember that this area has excessive movement of people. Pakistan, Bangladesh, Tanzania, Kenya, Somalia, you mention it. So those foreign influences coming into that area cannot be denied. Now, with the Sunna group, we have clearly seen that video propaganda material was propagated, and that at that point, this is what they grabbed onto. Not that there was an in-depth knowledge on extremists or an Islamist extremist interpretation. But that's not the issue. Low-hanging fruits, the way to go for these groups. But that a specific group, Shabab, never. They don't have an interest in this area.
That is Jasmine Opperman, the security and terrorism analyst based in South Africa. He was speaking to VOA Somali service reporter Haroon Maruf. This month and the past month of June, many African countries celebrated their independence. But as the celebrations continue, many question what that independence actually means to the citizens of these countries. In East Africa, Burundi celebrated 56 years since the country gained independence from Belgium. And reporter Moses Havyarimana is in the Burundian capital, Bujumbura, where he has this report.
Burundi claimed independence on 1st July 1962 and legally changed its name from Rwanda-Urundi to Burundi. The country became a constitutional monarchy with King Mwami Mwambutsa IV serving as the country's king. In 1959, Burundi's ruler Mwami Mwambutsa IV requested Burundi's independence from Belgium and the dissolution of the Rwanda-Urundi Union. UPRONA Party, led by Burundi independence hero Prince Louis Rwagasore, began to advocate for the end of Belgian colonial rule and the separation of Rwanda and Burundi. Burundi Vice President Gaston Sindimo is a member of the UPRONA Party.
After to kill Rwagasore, we have many crises. After 10 years, we have crises. After 10 years, we have crises. But now, we would like to stop those crises. We can do election without any supporting. But now we have some groups in opposition. They say that Burundian, we have crisis, we have genocide now. We show all peoples, all the world, that Burundian, we live in the peace.
Since 2015, when the incumbent President Pierre Nkurunziza vied for another term in the office, European Union, including Belgium, suspended direct aid to the Burundi government, which contributed almost 50% of the country's budget. Since then, the country's economic growth declined from 4.6% in 2014 to 1% in 2017 due to lack of foreign exchange. Ngendakumana Patrick is a businessman in Bujumbura.
If we try to see, the economy of the country is not in a good way, even if the security now, we can say that is a little bit good, but the most important thing in independence is the independence economically. If you are not independent economically, you mean that is a problem.
The Prona Party is more known to have played a great role in the country's independence, but since 2015, the political party was divided, with only one faction being recognized by the Burundi government. Tasia Simomana is a member of the faction which is not recognized by the Burundi government.
The small party cannot accept to be united with us because we have no longer the same vision. There is no vision of the development of our country.
The Burundi Vice President Gaso Sindimo believes that Iprona party was never divided.
We have only one Iprona, but there is some people who would like to use the name of Iprona because they say that name is very power in the peoples. Iprona is the party for independence, is the party for unity. Iprona party is not the same as the other parties because we must conserve that independence.
As Burundi Today is celebrating the 56th Independence Day, opposition members say respecting human rights and democracy in the country is a major challenge for the current government. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Thank you, Moses. And even as the last African team exited the World Cup, there's still a lot of interest in the global tournament all over the African continent. In Nigeria, the love for football is ever present in all aspects of life, a factor that has fueled the growth of sports betting in the country. Reporter Samuel Okocha is in Lagos, Nigeria's commercial capital, and he looks at how the World Cup season affects this popular subculture.
Soccer fans gather here at this viewing center in Lagos to watch teams play at the ongoing World Cup in Russia. But this viewing center also doubles as a sports betting shop where I met Niyi Abdul Latif.
Every time of the league, I know how much I win. But now, I don't win anything.
Niyi has been betting for 7 years. He follows the major football leagues in Europe and says the league season offers more opportunities to make money. That's because during the league season, dozens of games are played on each match day. But that's not so in the season of the World Cup.
One we play 1 o'clock, another one we play 4 o'clock, another one we play 7 o'clock. Just 6 countries. That's 3 games a day. There's a difference there. During that time, we can choose 30 games a day. And the 30 games that we play the same day.
Meanwhile, surprises at this World Cup has also not helped matters for those who want to bet ahead of games.
Imagine Argentina to lose to Croatia, Argentina to draw with Iceland. Brazil cannot even win Switzerland. They're playing 1-1.
That's Jude, an operator of the small betting shop where Niyi and other young Nigerians also come to watch games from the ongoing World Cup. He says the high unpredictability of match results at the World Cup has made sports bettors to invest very little compared to what they put during the European League season.
If they come to bet in World Cup, they will say, oh, let me just put 100 naira, 500, 1,000. But in league, when people come, they will bring 50,000, 20,000, 100,000, 30,000 naira to bet. People put more money in league than this World Cup.
Nigerians' love for football has led to the growth of a sports betting culture that has over the years seen dozens of sports betting companies open shops in Nigeria. According to Valiant Moweta, a research analyst with Lagos-based investment banking firm Afrinvest, the popularity of European clubs, helped by increasing access to the internet, has contributed to grow the culture of sports betting in Nigeria.
We follow the Premier League as much as they do in Europe. You need to hear when people are analyzing some clubs and all. We are up to date on the latest news. So the fact that there's an increasing fan base and technology too, making information you need to make informed decisions about your bet or about sports very handy.
those are the major drivers of the sports betting industry in Nigeria.
Meanwhile, sports bettors like Niyi can't wait for the league season to return to start making money.
We are waiting for the league. The league will start on August 11th. That's what we are waiting for now.
For VOA News, Samuel Okocha, Lagos, Nigeria.
And now for some World Cup news with Samson O'Malley. Good morning, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Jackson. We begin with the latest update from the 2018 World Cup in Russia. The knockout stages of the 2018 FIFA World Cup took center stage on Saturday as France faced Argentina in the first match of the day at the Kazan Arena. Kylian Mbappe earned a penalty and scored two goals as France defeated Argentina 4-3 in a thrilling 2018 World Cup last-16 clash at the Kazan Arena. A three-goal salvo in the space of 11 second-half minutes saw Le Bleu come from behind to defeat the Albert Celeste and become the first team to ink their name in the quarterfinal lineup. In the second match of the day, Uruguay's Edinson Cavani scored two goals to help his side book a spot in the quarterfinals as he overpowered Portugal 2-1 in a highly anticipated match at the Feast Stadium. Those two results from the two matches on Saturday meant the world's biggest football stars, Lionel Messi of Argentina and Cristiano Ronaldo of Portugal, will not take further part in this year's tournament as the Uruguayan side faces France in the quarterfinals on Friday. And then on Sunday, Spain suffered a shock defeat to Russia in the 2018 FIFA World Cup at the Luzhniki Stadium in Moscow. Russia's Golden Eagles won 4-3 on penalties following a 1-1 stalemate, and they progressed into the quarterfinals while the Red Fury of Spain are eliminated from the tournament. In the late kickoff, Croatia overcame a stubborn Denmark side as the match ended in a 1-1 stalemate and the Blazers advanced to the quarterfinals after winning 3-2 on penalties, while the Danish Dynamite bowed out of the competition. Russian goalkeeper Igor Akikev declined to take any credit for seeing his side through to the World Cup quarterfinals after beating Spain on penalties, insisting the hosts were just lucky. After the game ended 1-1 after 120 minutes, Akikev made two saves in the shootout, including a sensational stop with his trailing boot to deny Iago Aspers and seal Russia's spot in the quarterfinals. And Russia's Alexander Rekohin made the latest piece of World Cup history on Sunday when he became the first man to appear as a fourth substitute in a tournament match during the host game against Spain in Moscow. FIFA introduced a new regulation for the 2018 World Cup that allowed teams to use a fourth replacement in extra time, and coach Stanislav Cherezov took advantage of it halfway through the first period, sending on Yerohin for Dela Kozyayev. Spain would also send on a fourth substitute with Rodrigo coming on for Marco Asensio. The game was level at 1-1 after 90 minutes and also at the point of a fourth change. In today's fixture, Mexico and Brazil will square each other up when they meet in the last 16 tie at the 2016 FIFA World Cup at the Samara Arena. In the second game, Belgium will face Spain. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in St. Petersburg, Moscow. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth discussion on the 31st African Union Summit underway in Mauritania. The 2018 theme is Winning the Fight Against Corruption, a Sustainable Path to Africa's Transformation.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. Dax Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.